Sunstone does not necessarily endorse the opinions expressed in these presentations, nor the character of the presenters. Presenters must follow Sunstone's code of conduct, available online at bit.ly/sunstoneconduct. Those who violate it are thereafter banned from Sunstone events. Since this session was recorded, multiple people reported having been sexually abused by panelist Tom Kimball. To provide opportunities to learn from the past and to keep the historical record intact, Sunstone will continue to make this session available. For more information, visit sunstone.org/connect/news. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673.
As a minority perspective, and in some ways, I think each one of us looks at ourselves in many ways as members of minorities, not just within the LDS faith. I happen to have grown up in a very small town. When I was in high school, I got on a bus and rode 5 or 6 miles to the big city where I went to high school. And I always felt myself somewhat as a marginal person, even though I was a good athlete. I got a scholarship to BYU. I was very active in theater and music and all of that. But I always felt somewhat, I'm this little country kid attending this great big school of 500 students. And I was sort of marginal in terms of that self-identity. I think each one of us as LDS members probably feels somewhat marginal. At least I have. My whole life I've felt somewhat like I'm not really a part of all of that. And no matter where you go, you can't help but carry that with you. The Walls here attended the University of Michigan at the same time I did. And when I took a position at UCLA, I'm just making reference to this because to establish kind of a connection with them. There was a young man who also came to the sociology department at UCLA, right from Michigan at the same time. And so I called him and said, you know, let's get together. We've been displaced here in Los Angeles. And so the first thing he asked was, well, you know, where are you? Where are you located? And what are you doing? And I reciprocated. And he said, but yeah, I'm in sociology. And I said, oh, you must know Leon Mayhew. And he said, oh, you're Mormon. You know, just like that, you know. Because Leon was an assistant professor at Michigan, and immediately, within 2 minutes, I was then stereotyped, you know. Well, of course, he made this really very nice for me, because what he then said was, oh, we each have our cross to bear. And that made it okay. That's okay. So my marginality in some ways was sort of relieved through that. I divide my paper into three sections. The first section, I give a little bit about my own biographical background. Some things, and these little vignettes I have in the paper are fairly only illustrative. In that I just wanted to give a sense that there are times in people's lives that sort of click as significant. And within the developmental frame, Tom, I gave a story of a crisis I faced at the age of 9, when I began to worry about eternal life. And eternal life, that seemed to be fairly formidable to me, and I didn't want to live eternally. That seemed to be just so terrible not to be able to die. You know, here's a 9-year-old kid. And it spun off into a whole bunch of different directions. And one of them, that was a real trial to me, living in this little town of Salem, Utah, at the time, I began to ask myself about the place that I was located in the world, because my family had always told me, you know, you're living in the best country in the world. You're living in, you're a member of the true church of Jesus Christ. Utah is the best place in the best country of the world. We were not low class, so we were one of the better families in one of the best places, in one of the best countries, in the only church. And as a 9-year-old kid, I could barely unravel that. You know, this probably doesn't happen to many people at the age of 9, but I was, that really gave me pause for consideration. So those little kinds of stories all along the way sort of begin to define one's place in the world. Another story that I told was really quite significant in terms of my relationship with the church. Shortly after I received my PhD, I went to the University of Hawaii as an assistant professor, and was called as a member of the bishopric almost tonight. And I spent a couple of years in the bishopric there. And that was a very significant situation for me, because I found myself, having lived in the church, come from a very, very mainstream LDS, you know, my father was a member of the state presidency, he was the bishopric throughout my whole life. And I was really very centrally involved as a member of a mainstream Mormon family. I found my calling as a member of the bishopric was probably the most crippling thing I could imagine. And it may sound as a contradiction to many of you. But this was back in the Vietnam crisis, the student rebellion days, and I had prided myself in looking fairly generally and objectively at the world and being able to respond fairly openly. And I found, as a member of the bishopric, I was absolutely shut down. If I was conducting a meeting in the church and someone said something that was awful, that was prejudicial, that was not correct with what I perceived to be the principles of the gospel, all I could do is up and thank the person for their testimony and their conscientious contribution to the church. Whereas if I had not been a member of the bishopric, I could easily have walked up and said, that was a terrible talk. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that as a member of the formal organization that had invited that person to give that speech. And so I felt just absolutely constrained. And so it was at that time that I made the conscious and deliberate decision, the church is very dear to me. It's very central to my life. I don't want anything to interfere with that cherished kind of relationship with the church. And so I made the conscious decision about 35 years ago, I cannot serve in the central core of the church, because it alienates me. It alienates me on a course where I may be in a position where I feel I'm going to have to leave. And so for the last 35 years, I must confess, I've do lots of welfare projects. I have a lot of home teaching. I teach regularly in the high priest group. That's wonderful, because that's the one place when I can be as open as I want to be, because I don't have to worry about Mr. Joe over there, who just joined the church and is somewhat unstable. And so we can be as open as we can within that kind of framework. And that may surprise some of you who've never been in the high priest group. Right now I'm the ward music director. And that's a wonderful calling, because I get to choose all hymns for sacrament meeting, among other things. And one of the big crises I always face is that I want the congregation to sing things that the bishop doesn't think is, because he's a convert of about 10 years. He doesn't know the old hymns that I love. And so about every week he comes and says, Val, don't choose that kind of a hymn, you know. It is something I don't know, something that I'm not familiar with. And so we're continually moving back to about a half a dozen hymns, and we sing those over and over and again. But anyway, that's been my life in the church, and it's been one that I deliberately say is one of the, being a marginal kind of person. In the academic world, there is a fairly large literature on marginalization. And I'd just like to read two or three quotes to you, or with you. One is from W.E.B. Du Bois. Du Bois wrote The Soul of the Black Folks about 100 years ago. He's a black. And this is one of the classic quotations. The Negro is a sort of seventh son, and there's something significant about that, seventh son. Born with a veil, gifted with the second sight in this American world, a world which yields him no true self-consciousness but only lets him see himself through the revelation of the other world. He sees himself through the revelation of a world that he's not a part of entirely. It is a peculiar sensation, the double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others and measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. Okay? Well, you can read the rest of that. But that's W.E.B. Du Bois. In many ways, he's confessing that he's an outsider. It's a difficult world for him to live in. And that reflects much of the literature about marginalization among racial and ethnic groups during certain periods. More recently, a different kind of consciousness has emerged, and I'll give you just a couple of quotes to give you a sense of that. Here's more contemporary bell hooks. I was not speaking of a marginality wished to lose, to give up, or surrender as part of moving into the center, but rather as a sight one stays in, clings to even. Because it nourishes one's capacity to resist, it offers the possibility of radical perspectives from which to see and create, to imagine alternatives and new worlds. Now that's, you know, do you see the difference? Bell Hooks is saying, hey, I'm here, I'm not in the core, and I like being here. It gives me a perspective. It gives me vision. It gives me the power to resist. Here's Patricia Hill Collins. Rather than reject our marginality, black women intellectuals can use our outside within stance as a position of strength in building effective coalitions and stimulating dialogue. You know, do you get a sense of the shift that has occurred, that people are now finding their marginality, forced marginality, I might say, forced marginality as something that is positive? I have a colleague who is just four doors down the hall from me. Some of you may have read Sandra Harding's stuff about her most famous book was entitled Whose Knowledge, Whose Science? Sandra saying, it's all male. Science is a man's world. Okay? But she's more reflective here in generally. Socially oppressed women have access to knowledge unavailable to the socially privileged, because they, as subordinate people, have had experiences that can bring into focus questions and issues not visible to those in superordinate positions. Now, this raises all kinds of questions. You know, it's like I can't appreciate being a mother because I'm a man. Yeah, that's probably something to that. You know, but the perspective in these marginalized groups now is one of very positive perspective. That it gives them insight, it gives them positions, it gives them vantage points that the superordinate folks don't have. And And so I wanted very much this morning, just in a few minutes with you, to share that and to suggest to you that I feel very comfortable as a marginal Mormon. Very comfortable. I do. And I'm not embarrassed to tell the bishop, no, I don't want to do that. You know, I was a family history instructor in our ward for a while, and I finally went to the bishop and said, Bishop, this really isn't what I should be doing, because ultimately in the church family, I'm a devoted genealogist. I spend days every week involved in genealogical work. It's a part of my historical background. In fact, some of you may see a book that's come out in the next few days or a few months. Should have been out 6 years ago. as a part of the University of Illinois Press, where I relate the ancestors of the early Mormons to a whole historical study. And these people were really marginalized radicals, if you will, the ancestors of the early Mormons, just like the early Mormons themselves were marginalized radicals. But that's what I do professionally. I spend days every week looking at genealogical family history kinds of things. But in my calling as the family history director, the main intent was to get people to go to the temple and do the work for their dead ancestors. And I felt very uncomfortable about that because I have chosen consciously not to go to the temple. It's just a deliberate decision I've made. And so I told the bishop that I don't feel comfortable doing that. You better release me and give me something that is more compatible with where I stand. Anyway, that's my position in the church, and I find it a very comfortable position. That's the second part of the paper. The third part of the paper is how I can be a contributing member of Jesus Christ and still stand on its margins. And I explore that just a little bit. And I'm sure each one of you could probably tell similar kinds of stories. But one advantage that I discuss is the advantage of thinking outside of the box, if you will. I think the church needs input from as many sources as possible. I'm vitally aware that the bishop should make the decisions, ultimately, for the ward welfare. The president of the church should make decisions for the welfare. And I don't argue that at all. I don't challenge that authority structure at all. The thing that I do point out in my paper is that it would be unfortunate if the bishop only received input from people who think exactly the way he does. Okay? And I use the analogy of the court jester in the old royal areas. You know, it was the stupid fool, the singer, the guy who was an outcast, who was the only one able to say the truth in many cases, and was very, very important for the welfare of the kingdom, because the king's advisor or the queen's advisor would only say what he or she felt the king needed, wanted to hear. Whereas the court jester could say the truth. And that's the way I sort of perceive my... I'm very open about where I am, who I am, what I think. And I don't care if people say, yeah, I'm the kind of the court jester, I'm the fool. I'm the guy next door who isn't credible within the mainstream framework. So what? What I have to say at times needs to be said. And if I'm the guy who has to say it, so be it. Okay? There are tremendous personal advantages to being on the margin as far as I'm concerned. Personal advantages. And I go through a litany of things that people might suggest. For example, am I prevented from praying more fervently because I'm on the margins and not on the core? Am I prevented from reading the scriptures more avidly because I'm on the margin than if we're on the core? Am I deprived of the gift of the Holy Ghost because I'm the ward music director and not the bishop? Certainly not. Certainly not. So those conventional means of spirituality are just as open to me as anyone.
The question is, are you prevented from making a contribution to a class because too far out? I'm prevented from that.
Oh, well, Len, the only thing I can say to you is that I know the boundaries, and I'm fairly aware of the boundaries. I don't question the authenticity of the Book of Mormon in class. I don't question that this is the Church of Jesus Christ in the Church. That's so fundamental and so central that I'm not going to raise the question, is there a God, is there not a God? There is a God. And His Son is Jesus Christ. That's so fundamental to the Church that I'm not going to question that, even though I recognize there are other kinds of possibilities. My wife is a practicing Buddhist, you know, and I respect her for that. But I'm not going to get up in church and say Buddhism is more efficacious than Mormonism. So there are boundaries that one has within one's marginality, of course.
But don't you find that your opinions that you do express are marginalized because you're marginalized? That's the thing I find.
Yes, you're the court jester, Donna.
Yeah, I have been for 2 years.
You're the fool. Continue saying exactly what you think, because you're the only one who's going to say it.
That's right.
And occasionally there are times when what you say is the most important thing that needs to be said. That's correct.
And that's one thing that I've found is that a lot of times my ideas are way outside of what can be said. And so, depending on the situation, I'll try to judge, well, what's at the boundary?
Exactly. Of course. Of course.
In what I think is the right direction. And I won't appeal to the core people, but there are always some people who say, they start nodding their heads and they say, well, I'm glad somebody else.
Absolutely. Well, and we're I really appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to your comments. Let me just end my presentation by stressing to you that I love and cherish my relationship with the Church. I really do. It's awkward. It is not something that I would recommend that other people do. It is painful at times. You know, I have 4 brothers and sisters living in the center of Utah who are wonderful people. and I find that terribly awkward. It's difficult. My 3 sons are no longer active in the church. They respect where I am. When they come to our home for family dinner, we still pray. We still do the conventional things, and they join in willingly. But they have chosen not to go to church, and that hurts me. That hurts me terribly. Although, in some ways, I do not apologize for my children. My 3 sons are some of the 3 finest people I know. I'm so proud of them. And their affiliation with the church does not diminish the quality of people that they have become. So But still, I would. It would be such a joy to me to have my sons accompany me to church. You know, they chose not to. And so there are painful parts of my marginal positions. But for me, it's the choice I've made and the choice that I'm going to continue to make in my life. Now, let's turn it over to Tom for a few minutes, and then we'll have a more general discussion.
My paper this afternoon is on similar topics. I'm going to be going over stage theory. But as I was going through your paper, I had wished somehow we could have merged our papers. But I am going to briefly go over stage theory just for a moment. Dr. James Fowler talks about human development in the framework of six stages. Stage one is the is where a child from the ages 2 to 4, where he mixes myth and reality together and learns whether or not the world is safe and whether it's not. In ages 2 to 12, the child begins to separate myth with reality. They create a them and us sort of worldview where the other can easily be forgotten, hated, very tribal, sort of like Mormons and Gentiles, I guess. stage three is clearly the most interesting stage to me. I like to compare it to the return missionary stage, where a return missionary will have a very fully developed worldview, know why God exists, what's the purpose of life, why people go through pain. Why they understand the science behind God and his motivations, as well as the reasons for metaphysical events and so on and so forth. The person in stage three views themselves not on the margins, but views themselves as sort of as the center, and will often defer decisions about the world and concepts to the group. My wife has a small study group. She's going through a human anatomy class right now, and they spend a lot of time together because it's a very difficult class. And so they'll often talk about stuff, sometimes just to break the monotony. And she'll say, talk to the other person, say, what do you think about this thing? And the person will say, well, this general authority says this about that. And so that's my worldview. And it's like, no, what do you think? And it's like, this other general authority says this. And that's the way, and they sort of defer to the group. That they have taken the time to make that they feel that the group itself has spent significant time and energy and has made those decisions, and therefore all they need to do is defer their decisions to them and trust them. Stage four is where we start to becoming marginalized. Stage four is when a person starts to this doesn't happen during your mission, or it might happen during your mission, but it usually happens later in life, in your 20s, and possibly as late as your 30s in my case, where you start to realize that the group decisions aren't necessarily your decisions. And if the group, your tradition, specifically Mormonism, the thing that they've decided happens to coincide with your decision, that's a bonus. But your decision doesn't necessarily reflect the group's decision. And it's sort of it's a difficult stage. It's an angry stage. It's an angry stage. And it's certainly a stage where you start looking at the world from your worldview from the outside for the first time. Stage five is where you, start to forgive, and you start taking steps back towards your faith. And stage six, I think, is interesting. I think it could be argued that stage six is being back in the center, in the sense that the world is around you, and not necessarily you on the outside of the world. Fair enough? Okay. So anyway, that's what's the thing with it at the moment, and be the subject of my paper this afternoon. But I have to say that I really enjoyed your paper. I saw myself looking at a few things. For example, the movie Pleasantville. Has anybody seen Pleasantville? I thought that that was interesting because here's a 1950s utopia, black and white. Everything is sort of black and white. I thought that was beautiful imagery. Everything is cut and dry, and everything's just pleasant. And then as people start to step out of that world, they become color. And it's not just that the world seems like a new world. The world is a new world. You have a new world. And the thing that was very touching to me in the movie, and something that I looked at and went, wow, was when the wife becomes color, and the husband, who is still black and white, still in stage three, you know, is saying, well, maybe you can, like, put makeup on, or, maybe, and she's saying, no, I can't, you physically can't go back. You know, you're there forever, and it's a new world, and there's no going back. And so she has to sort of decide, am I going to wait for him? And that's a problem in Mormonism, too. You know, a person begins to lose their faith, or they begin to perceive the world in a much broader way than their spouse. And that can cause problems. It can also cause problems within your neighborhood and your community and your employment. You don't know. I just want to point out a couple things I saw in the paper that relate to stage theory. You mentioned on my page, I don't know if I had the same. You say, however, too often the members in good standing tend to go along with the winds of opinion and are inhibited from expressing a minority point of view. That is stage three, in my mind, a Fowler stage three. And then in the next line it says, it may fall on the shoulders of a marginal person to express a view that provides an appropriate perspective and a critical view of this issue, which is stage four, or beyond. Maybe two more points. I grew up in West Valley, which is the west side of Salt Lake. It's the blue collar neighborhoods. Okay, my father shoveled coal up at Kennecott Copper, and I noticed that my community as a whole looked at the church and said, and saw the leaders of the church and saw them as white collar east side wealth, and we as west siders felt marginalized in a sense because of poverty and so forth. So one of my questions for you is what are the versions of marginalization? You're marginalized because you're a woman. You're marginalized because you're a minority. You're marginalized because of poverty. And with regards to your paper, how, you know, maybe that's something that we could play with a little bit, or that you could maybe address a little bit. And then finally, I'd like to point out that in looking back, I sort of had this mission in Birmingham, Alabama, so I know my Bible pretty good. It was survival. And it seems to me that in Jesus' time, there were the Sadducees, who were the politically conservative and the religiously conservative. Then there was the Pharisees. They were politically liberal but still religiously conservative, and yet they were the wealthy elite, and they sort of kept themselves, sort of like the parable of the publican and the Pharisee. They kept themselves apart from the masses, and yet Jesus, in my mind, marginalized himself by reaching out to the poor and to live among the regular people and the marginalized and the outcasts and the sinners, and sent his gospel to them. And they're the ones that grabbed it. The marginalized were the ones that grabbed their religion and ran with Jesus. And it was the people who were in the center, in my view, were the ones that rejected Christ. Anyway, thank you.
Could I just make one or two comments, Tom, in response? He was asking, I'm not a woman, I'm not low class, I'm not black or Chicano, so what am I? And there is a problem in terms of forced marginalization and choice of marginalization. That is, a woman has very, very few choices about being a woman or something else. There are people, and I know some, who have made a choice and who have changed. I find it difficult, Tom, to distinguish completely between the forced and the voluntary marginal. It may be a matter of self-discovery, that ultimately you decide, and Mariana, my colleague who came over with me this morning, was telling me about her process has been one of self-discovery, that over time she has discovered who she is, and if who she is a marginal person, then that's who she is, just like a woman is. You know, she goes through recovery as well. And so, in some ways, maybe I'm discovering who I am and reinforcing that.
Something I'd like to see explored, and not necessarily you, but at some point, is, in stage theory, men have a tendency to go into stage four because of their mind.
Yeah.
And I think women go through stage three.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's a very interesting idea. Could I just make one comment about stage theory, and then I'd like to open it up. And I feel stage theory sort of implies that you move from one level to the other and you stay there. I feel more comfortable with the idea of chakras. You know, symbolically, where your basic fundamental needs, then your sexuality and material power needs, and then you begin to go up through seven levels of chakras. The idea of chakras is not that you leave the basic necessities of life. You've got to provide for yourself. Sexuality is an important thing. The important thing is to recognize that you shouldn't get stuck in any one of those chakra levels. Freud was stuck. That's the problem. It isn't that you want to leave the lower levels. It isn't that you want to divorce yourself from the core of the church. It isn't, you know, you are moving almost simultaneously through all of these things at any given time. And that, to me, is probably a more appropriate for the way I think than to say, you know, those people over there are only at level three, and that woman hitting your boy is level two. And that, you know, well, I'm level two at times as well, and I'm level three at times. You know, and so it's anyway. Could we simply open it up now?
The question was, is in with regards to stage theory, that each stage you include more. I think it's a little bit different than that in my mind. And once again, stage theory isn't a real thing.
Yeah.
It's just a framework to have a discussion. And this gentleman is probably far more up on it than I am, but each stage has to be built upon. You can't go from one. You can't skip stages. You can't to spend time in each. You know, stage three. I complain about stage three because I feel like I'm in stage four, and I kind of view stage three as the enemy. But stage three is absolutely necessary. You know, as I've become into stage four, I was starting to wonder, well, what should I do with my children? You know, what do I do with my children? And it wasn't until I realized stage three is absolutely necessary that I started to realize, no, I have to raise my kids in the church. You know, I have to send them to Sunday school. Like, and they have to become wacky stage three Mormons, just like I was, you know. And that's healthy. What's not healthy is if they're 85 years old and they're still in the wacky stage three.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Does that answer your question?
I'd like to look at your description in more detail now, because I think that's an important
point, you don't become angry at people because they are at different levels or for instance, if someone is a core Mormon, sometimes I'm in a discussion group. I'm a convert, so I'm in a discussion group, and you can imagine that people say things, and I say, "Oh my God," so that I can maintain myself in that discussion and in as part of the church, is to say, "What are they really saying?"
Right.
What are they really saying that I can respond to as well?
That's an element of stage five. Stage four is the really upset, angry, where you're kind of upset at everybody, and you're kind of shunning. You aren't.
Yeah, right.
You've gone from being the center of the church to the margin.
Right.
And then stage five is sort of being able to play through the layers. That makes sense.
The only possible way.
Right. And I'm not there.
Yeah. I'm curious if you've ever thought about another term. Yes, because the very term is purgative to me. It's marginal, you know, and I wish there were another way to say it that made it less marginal. I guess I don't know what else to say. There ought to be a way to talk about it that gives it weight. Because the word marginal removes weight.
Yeah. And of course, if people, my wife talks about various stages of enlightenment. Okay, good Buddhist idea, you know. But even that is really off-putting when she says I'm more enlightened than you are.
Yeah.
And most of the terms, most of my globalization stuff is periphery. That isn't maybe as pejorative as marginal, but it still connotes the same kind of thing.
I don't mean to come up here. I thought you was talking to a mic up here, and I was going to say, "Where are you?"
No, the record.
So this guy's crazy up here. He's talking to the wall here. I just want to make a comment because I'm a bishop that has counselors that have radically different ideas. And so I like to hear different ideas. But you mentioned this thing about stages. And when you mention stages, that seems to imply that people are on different stages and that there's a progression of some sort.
That's
perspective. Okay. Well, I was just wondering, you mentioned that you're comfortable where you're at for right now. You teach at UCLA, is that correct? You have students? Do you ever have a student that says to you, I'm comfortable where I am right now? And how do you think would be a good way to respond to those type of students? You just say, do your own thing, or?
Okay, thank you, Dan. back to Piaget. Let's quote, cite Piaget. Piaget talks about adult going through the, or people, Piagetians talk about going through these stages, various stages, and the young kids coming right into college usually see themselves as being in a state of ignorance, but the assumption is somebody knows. The truth is out there, and somebody's got it, and the university is a good place for some of that stuff to be found. And they go through the process of academic maturation of thinking they're going to discover the truth and ultimately deciding it ain't there, you know, in an ultimate sense. But they may cycle right back where they were when they came into the university. And I think that's the point that some people are saying, that you make that choice, but it's a different kind of place. Even though you may say, I'm a good, mainstream, formal, obedient Mormon, but having cycled back to that place is much different than the person who is obedient and has no other frame of reference than strict obedience. And so, Jana?
I'm changing the subject just a little bit, if that's okay. I just feel like I really want to say this. Several years ago, like 10 years ago, I was on an airplane. I ended up sitting next to this guy. We started talking about Mormonism because I had a BYU bag. Turns out he was Mormon. We were on a long flight. And he had been a convert and was immediately put into a leadership position and had been a branch president and really got burned out and literally woke up one morning and left the church. Just said, I can't do this anymore. It's just too much. And it had been about 15 years since then. We started talking, and I said to him, he goes, you know, I kind of want to go back to the church, but I don't want it to overtake my life again. And I said to him very matter-of-factly, I said, well, just say no. I mean, what's going to do? They're not going to kick you out, you know. They're going to kick you out. And it was like the world opened to him, and he's like, really? He had no idea. And the rate at which people are joining our church, I really think it's important for those of us that have been here for a while to communicate that there is freedom to move in this structure while it seems so confining. You know, when some, you know, I've had people come up to me and they'll be like, oh, you know, I shouldn't say this, but I'm like, yeah, you know, say it. And I think that we can create that in our little ways, that spirit of openness, and let them know that it is okay to move, and that you know, they're going to be all right. So I just wanted to share that.
Wonderful. And could I put that in a somewhat broader frame? The church exercises unrighteous dominion, if you will. That is, you have to get your home teaching done, or you know, it's like some great force is going to come down on your head, or you have to go to the temple, or whatever. In fact, one of the insights I think I've gained, Janet, in that frame of reference, is the only coercive or the only power the church has over me is the power of love. Power of love. And I find that so rich in the church. As soon as I finally made the discovery that I don't have to do anything except respond to the love that they give to me. Okay? And to me, that's a wonderful force. That's a beautiful force that is exercised over me, and I accept it, and I hope I can reciprocate with that same love in the church. There were some other hands that were up.
That's all you know.
Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think I just wanted to make a comment to the earlier question that was asked. I think, regarding stages, it occurs to me, and I think, well, just to provide a little context to my comment, I'm a convert. I joined the church 12 years. I tried to stick it out on the margins, and then recently I've left. And I think the whole stages question, if I'm not mistaken, is based on concepts of, you know, precept, line upon line, precept upon precept, this whole business of progression that there's, and it seems that a lot of the thinking in the church is very linear, but understanding that there are, it seems that learning and the process of learning is very, very dynamic. Maybe if I understood the point of your question about, you know, if you have a student who asks, I'm comfortable where I am, I maybe possibly suggestive that they don't want to learn or they don't want to progress, that, which is, I think, the reaction I often get when, well, why would you leave the church? Why wouldn't you go to church? Like, well, you're not going to learn anything more outside of it, so why not just keep going? Or why would you not go to the temple? I think for me, it's like, well, the point of development that I'm in, it's more helpful for me to learn in other routes.
Very good. Yeah, there's no question. At some point, you probably have to leave the American Legion, right? At some point, there are some groups that you don't want to affiliate with, and I recognize that. That's a choice that each one of us makes about where those boundaries are. Yes.
Can we just hold longer?
So I actually have a very practical question. My experience has been probably of somebody who came from a very core, active family, and a very large, typical, you know, family from a size standpoint, and they have a very, very broad mix now of people that are engaged and not engaged in church and other kind of spiritual pursuits, and now I'm married to somebody who was very involved in the core, always felt marginalized, and has left. So one practical question is, now I have a different perspective, very much so about what it's like to be on the margins, even as somebody who's involved, but who doesn't represent a temple-going family, where everybody isn't involved in it, that kind of thing. So I'd be very curious to hear people's comments on how they either help people who are in these positions feel as much. I recognize that I'm as much a member of this church as anyone, and that somebody who, like my husband, is as much a value as anybody else, and that somebody who only comes once a year is as much value. But I don't think the church does a great job as being inclusive and helping people to feel that. I think we do a terrible job, frankly.
Yeah, we do a terrible job.
And it's a very, you know, kind of closed, yeah. You know, this is what a Mormon is. It's not very broad. So I'd like to hear people's comments about how they've seen people influence that culture that makes people feel more included.
My wife was 12 years before she became pregnant and had a baby. That was an awful time because the press of the church was that she's a mother, first of all. And so I recognize all of those inhumane things. But would anyone like to respond to Laura?
So you wanted to know how we dealt with that. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I'm from Irvine, and we have, I'm affiliated with UC Irvine, and there's four of us there who are starting our own, like, discussion groups, and basically we provide outlets for ourselves to express our concerns in an environment where we can still be Mormon, but we can still feel accepted. And so that's one way that we deal with that. But part of what I'm struggling with, and I guess this isn't a direct answer, but one of the main mechanisms that the church uses to create this outside-inside dichotomy is the temple and the temple recommend interview. I mean, that draws a line in the sand and it has tremendous impact on us. And I think, I don't think there's any way to get around that. If you can't answer the belief questions or have some sort of issue that keeps you from attending the temple, you're out of that core. And I don't think there's any way to deal with that.
Except unless you choose not to be in the core. I don't go for a temple interview because I don't go to the temple. So that's, anyway, Tom.
Of course.
I'm a marginal Mormon, absolutely. By choice, guys.
I think one of the problems, well, you know, my wife married a returned missionary, Eagle Scout, you know, fifth generation blue blood Mormon. Okay, that's what the package she thought she was getting. Then she ended up with me. So, you know, my spouse and I have dealt with issues of, you know, she being in one place and me being in another. And I find that, and I'm very fortunate, I'm the marketing guy for Signature Books. You know, I have 100 people around me who are interested in talking about Mormon issues. You know, 24/7, that's what I do for a living. It's great. And my poor spouse is stuck in the neighborhood in Utah Valley where I'm, you know, I'm certainly on the margins. So that's a tough thing. I think the biggest problem is for my spouse is opportunities to talk with people and to verbalize the issues. And I apologize for taking hostage of your session, but I feel that stage theory has given me a mechanism that I haven't had before to discuss what I'm going through and to be able to explain my experience. And my spouse, as she's slowly moving into stage four, she's been able to discuss these things and goes, oh my gosh, you know, you're right. She wants to run to the bishop and say, how come, is there room for me in the church, blah, blah, blah. And I keep saying, you know, maybe you shouldn't discuss it to him because he's not going to understand what you're saying. He's not going to get it. If you're going to ask him hard questions, you may be inflicting those hard questions on him and his family, you know, and forcing them into something that maybe they don't, you know, it's not, you know, why should we inflict that on him? He's a nice guy, you know.
You are the person to think, having difficulty with your children, you know, you want to have them embrace faith and love and hold the wonderful parts of the gospel that's provided for us.
Right.
But, you know, I guess using stage theory or just, you know, being on the margin, how is that okay for a kid who's
going to
be baptized?
But, you know, one of my great questions, and this is difficult for me because I have a 7-year-old coming up, and I've really struggled with the past several years is I've felt that maybe, and my spouse and I have talked about maybe even leaving the church, and you know, what would we do with our children? What do we do with our children? You know, is there another culture, something that we can put them into that they can go through Scouts and all, you know, whatever the things that we felt. And it was studying stage theory that made me realize that stage three or the true believing stage is a very healthy stage for people, and it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary. You have to go. And so, you know, we've decided that we're going to start reading the Book of Mormon with our children. We're going to do the whole nine yards. And we're going to allow them to progress just as we have the opportunity to.
Time is up, Donna. But Dan had his hand up 10 minutes ago, and he needs to.
I just want to say something. I'm Tom's brother. Okay, just so you can see where. That's why I'm here. Anyway, I just want to say real quickly, you know, that I am in the core. And be honest with you, I don't feel really comfortable there sometimes because, you know, it's not pleasant, some of the things I have to do. I'd rather be on the outskirts, to be honest with you. Okay? But just as sometimes people that are less active in the church or such as this brother back here, stereotyped. You ever feel like you're stereotyped? You know, people in the core get stereotyped as well. And I think to reach out, and I want to let you know that I look at the people I would love to have that are less active, or that are in the market or have other ideas, I would love to talk with them and associate with them. And I try to as much as possible. And that's really what should be done, I think, is you should be friends together and talk with other people and open some communication.
Could I just say the conversation should go on all day? Go to Tom's session, go to Len's session, go to hers, and same issues will be raised.
Right, you can talk all you want when we're through, but we are through. I want to thank Tom and Val for their presentations and for all of you for your comments.